shining and rippling like waves on the sea. We built steam.
Do you have some prairie in your future? Maybe you have some prairie right now. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. It's our prairie edition of Garden Talk today. Always fun to hear Lisa Johnson sing. Neil DeBoe, though, is not singing. He is talking, though. He is president of Prairie Nursery, recognized internationally as an expert in native plant community ecology. So we'll talk with him about what can be done in a native garden in the fall. And as always, we take your prairie gardening questions. What would you like to know about getting your prairie garden ready for fall? What about no-mow lawns? Questions there as well. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Neil, thanks for joining in today.
Larry, thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
Well, we've gotten many questions over the years about when to seed prairies in the spring or fall. I know you've talked about it, but what are the differences?
Well, there are some fairly significant differences in seeding a mix of prairie flowers and grasses in the fall versus the spring or this early summer. And there's another option called a frost seeding, which can occur in the latter part of winter when there's a modest amount of snow on the ground. So let's look at each one of those individually. Many of the prairie flowers require exposure to cold, damp conditions in the soil to break seed dormancy. And this is a logical outgrowth of just the nature of our season, where we have cold winters, summers, et cetera. So let's say I'm a prairie seed, and I fall on the ground on September 30th, and it's nice and warm, and it's raining, and I germinate. What happens? Well, all of a sudden, December, it's 20 below zero. I'm out of the gene pool, baby. So most of our prairie flowers have built-in dormancies where they require exposure to cold, damp conditions for a certain amount of time that, quote-unquote, tells them that winter has occurred, and then when the soil warms up, that it's safe to germinate, so they don't end up being one of those evolutionary dead ends that germinated in October. So to get higher germination on your flowers, fall seeding always results in better germination. Some species, it doesn't make a lot of difference, like your yellow cone flowers and black-eyed Susans and bergamots and coreopsis, well, the landscape coreopsis, these will germinate fine when seeded in April, May, June. But a lot of your other species, like pale purple coneflower and shooting star and blazing stars, many of these require exposure to these cold conditions in order to germinate at a higher rate. So for people that want lots of flowers, generally speaking, fall dormant seeding, and this is called a dormant seeding because they will not germinate until the following spring after winter, is the best choice. Now, many of your warm season prairie grasses, like big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass, and Cydos gramma, exhibit significantly reduced germination when seeded in the fall as a dormant seeding. And so if your goal is primarily grasses, warm season grasses, then you would plant in May or June. Generally, when farmers are planting corn, is the best time to plant your prairie grasses. So it does depend on what your goals are, what you're seeding, et cetera. This is not...
Are you there, Neil?
I'm here.
Okay. I lost your voice, at least from my end.
Okay, am I back?
You're back.
All right. So you have the lower germination of grasses, higher germination of flowers with a fall dormant seeding. And you'll have higher germination of the warm season grasses and lower germination on many of the flowers with the spring seeding or early summer seeding up until the end of June. But many of the prairie flowers that are seeded in May or June will germinate the following spring. They'll sit in the soil over the summer and the winter, and many will germinate the following spring or the second growing season, although not all. And then finally, you have the option of a frost seeding where the seed is scattered on the soil, usually late February, early March. And then you have the natural frost heave in the soil where the soil actually expands and contracts, opening little fissures in the soil where the seed can fall down into it and will also be exposed to these cold, damp conditions, breaking dormancy in the flowers. And that is a really good no-till method for seeding at an unusual time when there's still snow on the ground. You don't want a lot of snow on the ground because you don't want a big snow melt and the seed washes off. And you don't want hard, crusty snow because then the wind will blow the seeds away. So you want to have some soft snow. Usually you go out in the morning when the ground is frozen, scatter your seed, and then in the afternoon, the snow melts or the soil melts, and soil seed works its way down into the soil. So those are your three timings and the various results that you get. And a frost seeding generally results in good germination of both the flowers and the grasses. So that's why a lot of people do that.
And is the germination overall higher or lower, about the same if you do it, the frost seeding?
You'll get good germination on both the warm season grasses and the flowers and the cold season grasses with the frost seeding. So that's an advantage to that if you have the ability to do it under those conditions. And if you're using a machine to seed it and you don't have a lot of snow, you can use a broadcast seeder to scatter it on top of the snow and cover large areas, but you have to go out in the morning when the ground is frozen so you don't sink into the mud because it's going to thaw later in the day.
Yeah. Elliot in New Lisbon emailed a question for you. He put down an area for seeding last fall with the pollinator seed mix from Prairie. Would like to know about best practices that would benefit the area. He already mows sparsely down to about 3 inches, but wasn't sure if he should be pulling weeds or fertilizing to help establish the plants.
Oh, okay. Well, normally we recommend mowing at 6 inches in the first growing season, at least after a month or two of growth. You can mow it 3 or 4 inches to control weeds, which grow faster than the slower growing perennial prairie flowers and grasses. You can mow it 3 or 4 inches for the first couple of months, but after the prairie plants start to get taller, we recommend that you bring the mowing level up to 6 inches. If you seed it in April or May, usually you're going to bring the mower up to 6 inches sometime in July. We generally do not recommend fertilizing unless you have a very poor, nutrient low, sandy soil. Most soils have sufficient nutrients in them that there's enough nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, calcium, magnesium, et cetera, to grow the prairie plants, which most of which do not require a lot of nutrients. And fertilizing generally will just grow bigger weeds faster. So it can actually be counterproductive. The exceptions are dry, sandy soils, or there are also soils that can be very low in pH, acid soils, where you want to add lime or dolomitic lime to add calcium and magnesium, which are often lacking. And these are very important nutrients for plants. So it always is wise to do a soil test. If you have a sandy soil, send a test in, and the state lab in Marshfield can help you with that for a very reasonable price. It usually takes them 1 to 2 weeks to turn that around. So you can test for phosphorus, potassium, calcium, magnesium, pH, and part of the regular test also tests the percentage of organic matter. And rarely will you have a problem with micronutrients, but sometimes sulfur can be short, and you might want to check for that as well. So the other question besides the mowing and the fertilizing was pulling weeds. We do not recommend pulling weeds in the first year of a prairie seeding because the prairie seedlings can be pulled up with the weeds. And I've seen this where people pull up like a lamb's quarters, which has wide-spreading roots, and you pull it up, and you pulled up 5 prairie seedlings, and now you've got nothing. So we generally do not recommend pulling weeds unless you know exactly what the weeds look like and you can pull them without harming the prairie plants, which you also must know what they look like as small seedlings. And most people don't know what a little prairie seedling looks like. So pulling weeds in the first year is really strongly discouraged because it can cause more damage than good.
Yeah, that makes sense. Jeff in Racine has a question for you. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Larry and Neil. I have a city yard with a sizable rain garden in it, and it was kind of subsidized by our watershed group, and in the second or third year they donated a couple extra plants, and one was white wild indigo, and on the tag it said, if you're patient it will pay off. And boy, it took 5 years for that thing to get finally, you know, really established, and it's probably 3 feet high and 2.5 feet wide. And for the first year, I have seed pods on it. I'm wondering if I can take those seeds and somehow propagate them either by direct spreading into a city park that we work in, or if I can grow them in pots. And what's the process for that? Do they require stratification or what?
Sure. You can collect those pods, break them open, and you'll find these little round yellow, brownish yellow seeds, and you can scatter them in the fall. And they do require exposure to cold, damp conditions in the soils to germinate. And the Baptisias, the wild indigos, of which there are many, are kind of tricky. If you notice, when you open the seed pods and find these seeds, they're quite large seeds. There's about 1,600 seeds per ounce, which is a big seed in prairie terms. They have a very hard seed coat, which is true of most members of the legume family, pea family, of which the Baptisias are. So if you want to enhance germination, or sorry to say expedite germination, you can put the seeds in we use a little wooden box, and then we have a sandpaper holder, and you just scratch the seed with a fine, like 100-grain sandpaper, 120, 100-grain sandpaper, to kind of open up the seed coat, which will allow water to travel inside the seed. This will speed up the process of germination, because many times it takes a year or two for that seed coat to wear off so that water can get in there. Then the seed needs exposure to cold, damp conditions, and most prairie species, 30 days is sufficient to get really good germination, where you mix the seed with an inert material. We like to use fresh sawdust, which is slightly damp, and you mix the seed with 3 to 4 or 5 times as much sawdust as the seed. Put it in the fridge in a marked Ziploc bag with the name of the species and the date you put it in there, and take it out the requisite amount of time later. Some species only take a week, like lupine. If you keep it in the bag more than a week, it starts to germinate in the bag in the fridge. Not a good idea, so take it out after 7 days. Kind of a problem. Okay. But things like blazing stars and shooting star and coneflowers, these 30 days is plenty. Almost all of the plants will go with 30 days. But the Baptisias, we generally will run 90 days, 3 months. And even then, germination can be very tricky. And the worst of the worst are the irises. These are particularly difficult. They also require this process called scarification, where you scratch the seed with sandpaper and then subject them to this cold, damp treatment in the refrigerator. So the easiest way is to just scarify those seeds in the fall and scatter them in your field and let nature do all the work of stratifying the seed. This is a process of the moist treatment called stratification. And that will help them to germinate on their own schedule. But if you want to grow them in pots, you will want to follow these procedures of scarification and then 90 days of putting them in the slightly damp sawdust in the fridge, and then take them out and put them in your pots.
There you go, Jeff. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim in Norway, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Hey, the question I have is I inherited a prairie garden in the land that we own now, about 2 or 3 years ago. The people that owned it before created this prairie garden with a lot of rare prairie plants, and I want to continue that. Is there a place that where I can seek to buy these rare prairie seeds? And I presume in the process, maybe I can identify some of the stuff that I have in my prairie.
When you say rare, what kind of species are they? Do you know the species?
No, I don't. I know that the previous owner used to get these rare plants from Madison and plant them. I think first I probably need to get an assessment, but then after that, I would like to continue the work that she's done.
Yeah. Are you able to contact the previous landowner and find out where she got the plants?
I haven't been able to do that. She just said it was out of Madison. I think there's a prairie plant outfit that specializes in rare plants.
I'm scratching my head on that one.
I am too.
Do you have photos of the plants, Jim?
You know, I can take. Yeah, I've got photos of the plants. They're very unusual, and but they're also very beautiful. A lot of them are flowering plants.
Well, you don't know any of the names of them?
No. Unfortunately not.
Well, I can tell you there's a small nursery called Blue Stem Farms in Baraboo. And they specialize in some unusual hard to grow plants like wood lily, orchids, etc. So you might want to check out Blue Stem Farms in Baraboo, Wisconsin. They do specialize in unusual species.
Yeah.
And they're not in Madison. So they're not in Madison, but I'm trying to think who that would be, and I honestly don't know.
Well, it could have even been your company, Neil. Could have been Prairie Nursery.
Well, you know, I will tell you something. I used to have a botanical garden at Prairie Nursery many, many years ago. And there were plants that I tried to sell and nobody wanted. I thought, why don't people want these plants? Well, because they didn't have big, showy flowers. You know, they had great ecological services, but they didn't match the concept of a perennial flower. So now some of these have now become popular and we're able to sell them now. But there were so many species that I grew that nobody wanted, so I just discontinued growing them. And here's the problem when you're dealing with rare plants. Those rare plants usually have very specific niches in which they grow, whether that's certain soils or habitat types, et cetera. And when you're selling to the general public, most people do not have a specific niche in which those species grow. And so you end up with a lot of dead plants, a lot of unhappy customers, and a lot of replacements. And you can replace and replace, and it's never going to make any difference because if the site isn't right, the plants aren't going to make it. So it becomes not only a diseconomic pursuit of growing these rare plants, but it also leads to a lot of disappointment with your customers. So,
yeah.
So I kind of pared back a little bit many years ago because of these sorts of issues and the difficulties associated with very specific rare plants that need these certain conditions in which to grow.
And so what's the name of that company again in Baraboo?
It's called Blue Stem Farms.
Okay.
Or Blue Stem Farm. I think it's singular. Blue Stem Farm.
Okay.
Okay. And Scott and Muffy are on it, and I'm sure they'd be more than happy to assist you.
Jim, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Neil DeBow, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery, consulting ecologist as well. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Jane Rotunda, our on-air producer. And Nigel O'Shea's our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Neil DeBow, president of Prairie Nursery. Great to have him back. Certainly, if you have questions, I hope you'll join in with emails or calls at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Annalisa in Green Bay. Hi.
Yeah, this isn't a prairie question. This is a vegetable garden question. I have too many asparagus plants, and I want to get rid of some of them. And I'm just wondering, how hard is it to dig those up? And can they be transplanted? I have somebody who would like to have some, but I don't know if you can do it. So I just wonder, what am I in for here?
Yeah.
Larry, you want to handle that or should I?
Go ahead, Neil.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you can really do it well, but maybe you can.
Well, you know, like any plant that you're going to transplant, you want to do it when it's dormant. There are some plants you can dig up and plant when they're growing, like irises and daylilies, and you can't kill them. But for safety purposes, you wait until the plants are dormant. And with the asparagus, they will turn golden in the fall. And then once their leaves have turned no more green, completely golden, you can dig them up. Now, if the asparagus were properly installed, the roots are about 2 feet deep.
Yeah.
Because you dig a trench. Having done this.
Yeah.
Having done it once. And dug the trench and filled it with compost and put in the asparagus. So you're going to have to dig way down, assuming that the plants were installed correctly. You're going to have to go down 2 feet. So you're going to have to redig the trench, and you're going to have to dig all the way outside of it because the roots will have undoubtedly expanded from the original. So you're going to have to dig at least a foot wide to extract the roots safely. But if you pull them out either in the middle or late fall after they go dormant, or very early in the spring where you can see the old stems, you can dig them up very early before they come up and move them. But you really want to do this when they're dormant. You don't want to disturb them when they're growing. I've never tried moving asparagus when they're growing. I don't think it'd be a good idea.
No, I couldn't imagine it would be. Dave in Broadhead, we'll go to you next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I have a question on, I've got a butterfly weed. We transplanted one last year because they had just not been doing anything. We had them in a garden where they got covered up by peony bush and covered up by Russian sage, and they just weren't doing anything. So we moved one of them. This year, it just took off. It bloomed like crazy. There's two more of them in this garden, and they're not doing anything. They're just sitting there, just barely hanging on. I'm wondering, can I transplant them now, or do I have to wait until try and mark where they are? Because they're really hard to see when they go dormant. Just mark where they are and try and dig them up later on.
Definitely mark them and dig them when they're dormant. Absolutely. And I'm surprised because, you know, butterfly weed is a tap-rooted plant. Were these young plants? Are they only a couple of years since you put them in there, or have they been there for a while?
No, they're only a couple of years old.
Okay, so you were able to get most of the root without going 5 feet deep.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
one we transplanted last year, yeah. We took as big a dirt ball as we possibly could and then replanted it, but we put it in a little garden section all by itself, so there's nothing else there except it, and it just loves it now.
Sure. Yeah, you want to get as much of that taproot as you can. So normally you want to go down at least 2 feet, depending on the age of the plant, and dig that up. But you definitely want to wait till it's dormant. And when you transplant butterfly weed, you're going to think the next spring that it didn't make it, because it's going to take it a while to become reaccustomed to its new growing zone and new home. And butterfly weed is one of the very last of our native plants to emerge in the spring, because it only grows under warm soil conditions. So you're going to sit there in May and go, where's my butterfly weed? And then it'll be into June, and finally it will emerge. And you'll say, oh, good, thank God it made it, hopefully.
Okay.
Good luck.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Someone phoned in and said the caller who had gotten the rare plants from Madison, or the previous owner, may have purchased them at the UW Arboretum plant sale.
Oh, that makes sense, of course. Right, right. Yes,
yeah.
Good point. Yeah, of course. I should have thought of that.
I should have thought of it, too, because often have folks from the Arboretum on. So there you go. So that's and the plant sale, of course, this year was not held, if I'm not mistaken. But
yeah,
maybe,
I believe that's right. Yeah.
But next spring, go online to the UW-Madison Arboretum, and you'll probably get some information about the plant sale if it's going to be held. Judy in Custer, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Neil and Larry.
Yes.
I have in my vegetable garden big mats of low-growing clover. And I also have in my lawn, which is just an ordinary lawn, big dead patches where I've reseeded often and the grass doesn't take. Can I transplant those mats of clover into my lawn? Because I don't care if I have grass or not, as long as it's nice green plants in there. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
Judy, is this white clover? It stays really low, and it has white flowers?
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you can't hardly kill that stuff, yeah.
No.
And it's very shallow-rooted, so you can dig down. I mean, it would be just like transplanting sod. You could go down 2 inches and dig it up and move it, and you know, when you put it into its new home, make sure and water it in really thoroughly immediately after you move it, and it should transplant without skipping a beat.
Yeah, you could almost get a sod cutter into it.
Yeah, you could. I don't know if it would hold together. It probably would. It's got quite a mat. So it's not the same as sod of grass. It's a little looser. But, yeah, you should have absolutely no problem. What I would do is just take, like, 1 foot square pieces of it and take a spade and just dig down a couple inches and then get under it and get a couple inches of soil and move it to its new home, and you should have really good results.
Yeah. And you'll be fixing some nitrogen in the soil in your lawn. So there you go. That's what clover does. Let's go to Christy in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thank you. So so when we put newly purchased transplants from Prairie Nursery in the soil, eventually they'll fill in so the weeds are outcompeted and they become a non-issue. But until then, what is a preferred weed suppression in addition to just maybe hand pulling? Is it to take the lawnmower and, chop up nice organic leaves from the trees?
Well, I won't say that if you just put prairie plants,
from any source into existing vegetation, perennial vegetation, that the prairie plants are going to automatically take over. Because if that existing vegetation is perennial, it's going to be well established, and you're going to have a bit of a fight on your hands. And there's a saying that you got to think like an attorney. Possession is 9/10 of the law. And if you don't get rid of those plants that are growing there now, they're not just going to go away. They're not going to give up easily. So what we recommend you do, whether you're using transplants or even more importantly, seeds, you need to eliminate all the existing vegetation and get it out of there. Because there are some species that are really hard to control, like quackgrass, smooth bone grass, which are rhizomatous grasses and creep all over the place and cause nothing but trouble. And then, interestingly, in a prairie, plants like white clover that we were just talking about earlier can be quite a problem because they creep and invade by rhizomes as well. Although they tend to stay low, and if you're putting in transplants, the transplants will usually grow up over them, and it's not the end of the world. But it depends on what is in there as far as how the prairie plants will interact with them. So normally we recommend that you just eliminate everything. And if you plant your prairie plants close enough together, they will occupy both the rooting zone and the foliar zone, which will help keep out weeds. And that's the secret to a low-maintenance prairie garden, is you plant the plants closely enough that you don't have open soil between them, because it's open soil where weeds will grow. So the prairie plants are competing, again, both at the soil level with the roots and at the foliar level where they're shading out the competition. But you really must completely occupy that soil environment with prairie roots, and that keeps the weeds from getting established in between them.
All right. So you need to get rid of...
Yes. Now, there's a very good point here, and that is, what do you do when you put the young plants in, because they're not full grown? How do you keep the weeds down? So you have a number of different options. The organic option is to just put mulch around them and not use any chemicals or anything. And no matter what you do, mulching is really, really good, whether you decide to use other methods in conjunction with it or not. Mulching in between the plants is great. So the mulches of choice include weed-free, clean winter wheat straw. And make sure the winter wheat straw does not have wheat berries in it. Because if it does, you're going to have a wheat garden. I've been down this road, okay? So make sure when you buy straw that it doesn't have wheat seeds in it, because I get it from my neighbor, and I tell him, Sven Bob, I need to help you set your combine so you don't lose half your crop into the straw. So, and then I use it for mulching my vegetable garden, and all of a sudden I've got wheat coming up everywhere in my vegetable garden. You don't want that. So make sure that it's good, clean straw. And that, put it down about 3 inches thick between the plants, and that will suppress germination of wheat seeds and minimize, almost reduce, all weeds, and also holds the moisture in so you don't have to water it very often, if at all, if you get normal rain. Yeah. Some people prefer to use shredded hardwood mulch, I should say. And that works perfectly well, too. A couple inches of that does a great job. What you want to avoid are these bark nuggets or pine nuggets. This is death to native plants. I had a customer that did this. He killed half of his prairie garden by putting those pine nuggets down. So avoid those at all costs. And some people will use a pre-emergent. And this is really, really a great two-step system where right after you put all your plants in, you put down a pre-emergent herbicide. There's many different types. A commonly used one is Preen. Not that I'm saying you should use, but that's the only one. There's many others out there. And then you put your mulch over the soil, but you want to put the pre-emergent down first because it has to come in contact with the soil to prevent weed germination. If you don't want to use a chemical, you can use corn gluten. And corn gluten is an organic pre-emergent that really does the same thing as an herbicide. So you can put the corn gluten down and then put your mulch over it. If you're using a pre-emergent herbicide, you have to make sure all of your plants have been installed before you put it down, because if you put down the pre-emergent and then you're installing your plants and some of that pre-emergent gets down in the hole, it will create a problem called club root, because the typical herbicides, pre-emergent herbicides, are mitotic poisons, and they stop root development. They halt root development and cell division. And so that's what causes club root in the roots of plants that might experience it if it gets down in the hole. And that will basically halt the growth of those plants and could potentially kill them, but mostly it just stunts them. So put in your plants, put down your corn gluten or your pre-emergent herbicide, and then put down either your straw mulch or your shredded hardwood mulch.
She mentioned leaves. Christy mentioned shredded leaves. Would that work?
Shredded leaves are great too. Absolutely. Sorry, I missed that. That's very good. Most people don't have that, but yeah, if you rake up your leaves, absolutely. That's a great mulch. I use that on my woodland plant garden. What I do with my woodland plants is I cover them with about 6 inches of leaves. And I go around the neighborhood and people, they very conveniently bag them up for me so I can just put them in the truck, put them in the trunk and take them home and then scatter them and just cover my whole woodland garden. The 6 inches over the winter goes down to like 2 to 3 inches and then the plants come up right through it. And it helps to suppress weeds and add organic matter to the soil.
All right. There you go, Christy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Tim in Genesee Depot, it's your turn. Hi, Tim.
Well, hello, Larry. Hello, Neil. Neil, you and I spoke back in April after I had our new septic system installed, and I got a question regarding soils. I'm looking at your pollinator habitat in the catalog, and it's describing well-drained gravelly, sandy, well-drained sandy loam, clay loam, etc. Could you please describe the difference between those soils? And then secondly, I'll be planting the pollinator end of September, October, and should I use I've got lots of hickory trees and oak trees around. Can I just use those leaves as mulch on top of the newly planted pollinator seeds?
Okay, hang on. Let me ask you a couple of questions, okay, Tim?
Sure.
Okay, so you're putting it on a new septic system, and is this the sand and gravel backfill, or did you put topsoil over it?
Actually, this is the old leach field. The new leach field is up the hill. It's a pumping system. This is going to be the old leach field that had a lot of wildflowers in it and whatnot, but now it's just completely barren dirt. So there are rocks in it, but there is something that appears to be clay, but there's stuff that seems to be sand and some black or brown dirt.
Okay, this is a really important distinction. I'm glad you brought this up because a lot of people plant prairies over their septic leach fields or their mound systems. Typically, the contractor will bring in 3 to 6 inches of quote-unquote topsoil to put over the sand and gravel backfill that is used for the leach field. We have a septic prairie seed mix that is composed of dry loving flowers and grasses that go straight into the sand and gravel backfill without topsoil. But when you put topsoil on, then you have to probably go to a medium soil mix, which is where you get into the sandy loams, loam, silt loams, et cetera. So I just want to make sure that we have selected the right mix for the soil conditions that you have there. So the question is, how deep is this topsoil material? What is the nature of it? Is it really clay? Is it more loamy? And that will be important in determining what will grow there best. So to go back then to your question about the difference between sandy loam, loam, silt loam, clay loam, silty clay loam, loamy sand, silty, anyway, it never ends. You need a textural triangle. So Google textural triangle, and this will show you all the combinations of different soil types and classifications. And basically, this is the mineral soil portion of any given soil. It's not including organic matter, and it's not including gravel, cobbles, et cetera, anything larger than 2 millimeters. Sand is defined as anything 2 millimeters or smaller. So the three main components of soil are sand, the larger particles, clay, the very fine and small particles, and silt, the intermediate-sized particles. So the combination of sand, silt, and clay in terms of the relative percentages of each will determine whether you have a loam, sandy loam, silt loam, silty clay, loam, sandy loam, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's all a game of percentages. Okay, so I could spend a whole lot of time on this, but let's simplify. Loam is the combination of relatively equal proportions of the three particles, sand, silt, and clay. The state soil is the anagos silt loam. Now, why is silt loam the state soil? Because silt loam has the highest plant available water capacity of any soil, which makes it a very good agricultural soil. And silt loam also is very good at holding nutrients. Most of your nutrients are held on clay particles, and silt loam has the perfect combination of enough clay to hold water and nutrients and silt and sand for drainage. So it gets kind of technical. We're getting into the weeds here, but Google textural triangle, and it will show you all the relative percentages of each, and you will learn more about the soil than you probably ever wanted to know.
And just as a little addition to that, the person who really pushed for estate soil was Francis Hole, a soil scientist at the UW-Madison, a great, great guy.
Unbelievable guy, huh? Look at all the great professors at UW. It's just amazing. Look at that history.
Francis would take his violin to class, and he'd say, here's what anagosilt loam sounds like, and here's what sandy soils sound like, and then he'd play his violin.
That is amazing. I didn't know that, Larry. That's so cool.
His lectures were always packed, many with, if not his own students, a lot of other students who just wanted to come hear him talk.
Yes.
Anyway, that aside, Tim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Neil DeBull, our guest, president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist. Great to have him with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Taking a look at prairies on this edition of Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery. Great to have him back, and certainly good to have you listening in, and good to hear your questions and to see your questions via email at ideas@wpr.org. We have callers online. We'll go back to the phones, and Nancy in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Neil. One of my most favorite shows to have on. I have a prairie that's 10-plus years old, and it's on a hillside. And I have royal catch fly. And when I started out, I have one plant, and now I have four. So not growing very fast. But I was wondering, it is very tall and very wispy. And generally, a wind will come or something and blow it, and then it, you know, bends over. So because I have so few, I'm reluctant, like, to just cut it back and see what happens. So is there a way that I can make this thing stronger? I mean, what would cutting it back make it shorter and more strong?
Hmm. Well, I've never tried this, so I can't tell you. Now, generally speaking, if you look at the growth form of the royal catch fly, it is very upright to start with. And I have the same problem with some of my plants. And one of the tricks to this is to plant it not too far away from some prairie grasses that can provide it some support, like maybe some little bluestem to help block the wind. But that's only works so well depending upon the strength of the wind. That is one of the things that the prairie grasses do in a prairie garden, that they do help to support the flowers, at least to some degree. You could do an experiment with one plant and cut it back probably sometime in mid-June and see if that stimulates it to side branch and keep in more compact form. But I wouldn't cut it back all the way. I would maybe cut half of the vegetation back on the stem and see if it branches out. But again, I've never done this, so I don't know. Cutting it early is probably not going to kill it. It'll probably be okay as long as you don't take more than half of the vegetation, half of the leaves off. But you're in uncharted territory. Maybe somebody else out there has done this and knows, but I have never experimented with this.
Okay. But, you got four plants, worth a try on one anyway, Nancy. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Rick in Northwestern Wisconsin. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you once again. Great show. You're making Wisconsin more and more beautiful. Thank you both for being on today. This is great. This is regarding lasagna gardening methods using kind of a sheet composting with cardboard and mulch and soil to block the light and start over in areas where I'm just fighting weeds and invasive species. I'm just putting cardboard over the top to block the light and then building a layer. But I had read about lasagna gardening years ago, and I'm just wondering if you're seeing that as a accepted method. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks again.
Great.
Yeah, go ahead, Neil.
I'm just going to say it's a great method, and Larry probably knows more about it than I do.
Well, I don't know that I know any more about it than you do, but it – listen, Rick, it's a good method to use. And there are some really good online bits of information about lasagna gardening. Certainly the cardboard, that approach that you had, I think is a good one, and I don't see any problem with that either.
You know, we recommend this for people who don't want to use any herbicides to kill the vegetation or don't want to constantly till it up, which is kind of a lot of work. So what I suggest is people go to appliance stores that are getting rid of cardboard, and the recycling of cardboard now, the value has dropped so much that it is really even hard to get rid of. They will usually give you the big cartons of cardboard, which are much simpler to use than small pieces of cardboard.
Yeah.
I remember the old days. Remember the old days, Larry, when we used newspaper?
Yeah.
Okay, think about that. Okay, we put down layers and layers of newspaper, and then the wind would blow, so you had to put like fence posts and logs and rocks on it. But and you still have to do that with the cardboard, but you get these great big hunks of cardboard from the appliance stores or, you know, places where that sell these sorts of things, refrigerators and washers and stuff. And that is the way to do the lasagna gardening. You have to start with that on the bottom, and then put your compost and soil, et cetera, on top of that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great suggestion. So good luck, Rick. Thank you for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Mike in Lake Mills, your turn.
Good morning.
Hi, Mike.
Thanks for taking the call. Hi. Another mulch question. We have a mushroom farm nearby, and once a week he sells mushroom mulch. It's not the stuff from the store, but I think he cleans out his growing cellars and that. It's real cheap, and it forms kind of a crust over the lawn, or I mean over the where you're planting your plants. I'm wondering if your guest has any knowledge of it, any nutritional value or opinions. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Larry, your guest doesn't know much about mushroom mulch, I'll tell you that. I have no experience with it, so I really don't know. Not in my area of expertise. Do you know anything about that, Larry?
I certainly don't know anything about the nutritional value of it. It does form a kind of a crust on the soil, which could be a problem for some plants. But I have no idea about the nutritional value of it. No, I guess we can't help you out, Mike. Sorry.
I know it's high. It's very high in organic matter.
Yes.
So, I think one of the things you run into sometimes, you're going to want to watch out regarding the carbon nitrogen ratio. And oftentimes mushroom mulch has been depleted of its nutrients. And so you might have a high carbon to nitrogen ratio, which can actually impede the growth of plants or stunt their growth because of low nitrogen. And the bacteria and fungi that like to decompose organic matter in the soil can preferentially take up nitrogen more efficiently than most plants. And so this can lead to a condition called nitrogen depression, where the plants just do not have enough nitrogen because the bugs are getting to it as they decompose all that carbon. So I do believe this is one potential downfall or problem with the mushroom compost, although it's still a great source of organic matter. You may have to augment it with some chicken manure or some other form of organic nitrogen nutrition, or maybe regular fertilizer, depending on your approach.
Yeah. Christy in Chippewa Falls wondered about optimum soil conditions for frost seeding of your prairie plants, of your prairie seeds.
Optimal soil conditions for frost seeding. Optimal soil conditions for frost seeding would be, again, usually in the latter part of February, early part of March, depending on where you're located, and a few inches of fresh, non-crusted snow is perfect. Because the seed will settle into that snow, and as the snow melts, it will go down into the soil, and the soil will melt. It will thaw. My soil is melting. The soil will thaw in the afternoon. As things warm up later in the winter, it'll thaw in the afternoon, freeze at night, thaw in the afternoon, freeze at night, and then that creates these little fissures where the seed will fall down into it. You can also scatter it onto open soil. As long as the soil is frozen, you don't want to be out there when it's all muddy. So you don't absolutely have to have snow on the ground, but a lot of people like to have a little bit of snow because then the seed settles into the fresh, loose snow or soft snow. It can be, icy, but not, I mean, it can be little granules, but it can't be a solid icy cover because then the seed can blow off in the wind.
Janelle in Fort Atkinson, it's your turn. Hi, Janelle.
Hi, I've been a mulcher for 20 years, and I got a little frustrated about 5 years ago. I learned not to mulch too much to help keep, you know, the weeds and stuff down. I'm a mom of four kids, divorced and went through school and stuff. What I get frustrated with is 3 years ago, I had to go around the house and dig out all the areas I had mulched because obviously, you know, it was too high on the hose and too high around the trees and stuff. And I'm in a yard, you know, in a little neighborhood where I don't know where to go with this dirt anymore. And am I doing something wrong that my mulch is not decomposing enough where I have to go around every 3 years and dig it up to keep it low around the house and trees? Or I know this is a silly question, but.
What's your mulch? What's the mulch you're using?
I'm a cheap mom. I'm frugal. I get whatever's available in the community. And, you know, I watch, you know, that there's no, I watch for the right stuff, that there's no seeds or foreign stuff in it. I try to get it early enough, and that might be part of the problem. But I bought a new house, and doggone it, I wish I could transfer all this dirt, you know, an hour away from me now where I had dirt there, but I can't do that.
But it's leaves that you're collecting.
No, it's mulch from trees and stuff like that. Yeah.
Shredded wood mulch.
Yeah.
That's the issue. Like we were just talking about carbon nitrogen ratio.
Yeah.
So all that chopped up wood and bark has a very high carbon nitrogen ratio. And most plants have a carbon nitrogen, organisms have a ratio of like 18 to 1, 20 to 1, something like that. And when you get all those lignins and other high carbon, hard to break down compounds, especially in bark, there's insufficient nitrogen for it to break down. So if you keep adding, it's just going to build up. Now, slowly but surely, soil microorganisms, bacteria, fungi, actinomycetes can break this stuff down, but it takes a long time. So I think we need a mulch intervention here. So, and you know, mulch has become the go-to gardening method in America. And it's because it's easy. It keeps weeds down. Many people like the looks of it. But I tell you what, you go to England and go look at the English gardens, how much mulch is there?
Yeah.
You don't see mulch.
No.
You don't see mulch. And why is that? Because English are inveterate, brilliant gardeners, and they understand, like we were talking about with the prairie garden, they understand the relationships between the rooting zone and the foliar zone. And they know by associating the proper plants with one another, they can control the weeds naturally with the plant morphology, roots and leaves. So here in America, we just use this blunt force mulch program where we just stick a few plants in and then mulch all around them. And where this came from, I don't know, but it seems to be more or less the dominant paradigm now. Now, it does require significant knowledge of the plants themselves, including the roots, leaves, and how you put them together and how you mix them together in the garden, and also the kind of look you want. Some people don't like a tight, packed border garden like an English-style garden. Some people love it. But in America, somehow, we've come to this kind of individual plant separated by piles of mulch. Maybe that's all part of the American individualism. I don't know. But that's the style. And that sometimes can lead to mulch overload. And I think that might be what's happening here. So if you switch your mulch, go to leaves. Leaves break down. And different leaves break down easier. So when I'm scavenging leaf mulch and picking up the bags in town, I look for, well, in the old days, for ash trees, maple trees, basswood trees. This is sweet mulch, and it's generally circumneutral and has low lignins in it. Oak trees and hickory trees are slower breakdown, and they tend to be more acidic, and they have more difficult to break down organic material. They're great if you want a longer-term leaf mulch, but if you want something that's going to replenish your soil faster, then you go for the sweeter trees. So it really depends on what your goals are, but leaf mulch is great. Straw mulch breaks down faster, but a lot of people don't like the look of straw mulch. So if you're going to use wood mulch, just use it sparingly.
Yeah, I think the wood mulch, it was probably some good marketing a while back on wood mulch.
I like the red mulches and the green mulches and all the colored mulches too. That's good. You can paint them with the mulch in your yard.
There you go. Janelle, thank you very much for calling. We have Ken and Butternut with a question. Hi, Ken.
Hello, gentlemen. I have a question regarding canary grass. I'm letting my lawn go natural, and I've got all kinds of neat stuff coming up, with the exception of what I think is canary grass.
Reed's canary grass.
Yeah, and I need to kind of know how to control
that canary grass, because from what I understand, I'm going to end up with 2-foot-high stumps.
Yeah, we're kind of running out of time here, Neil. We got to. There's no quick answer to canary grass, is there?
Yeah. How much time do I have, Larry? Give me a time.
30 seconds. Yeah.
30 seconds. Okay. Here we go. Okay. Reed canary grass is a rhizomatous, cool season, non-native grass. It's most active in the spring, and there are two ways that you can control it. You can't pull it because it's all these rhizomes. So one method you can do is you can bundle the leaves together. And then apply with a little sprayer, Mr. Bottle, Roundup onto the leaves, making sure it doesn't drift onto anything else. And the other choice is to spray it with cefoxidim or clethodim, and that will kill most grasses, but it won't kill flowers. So that's two of your options right there.
There you go. Good luck, Ken. Thank you very much for calling. Neil DeBoe, our guest today. He is president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. Always fun to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. About prairie gardening on Garden Talk today. Larry Mueller here with my guest Neil DeBoe, back with us, president of Prairie Nursery. He's also a consulting ecologist. So, what questions do you have about prairie gardening? Are you looking for plant recommendations? Maybe some problems you're having trying to establish your prairie? Number to call 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Debbie in Shell Lake has a question for you, Neil, so let's go there. Debbie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thank you very much for answering my call. You might recall that a number of years ago, Shell Lake had very high lake levels, and we essentially lost our entire landscape, and we ended up having to raise our cottage and re-landscape. And part of that effort, I elected to established 3 areas of prairie, short grass prairie, in what would otherwise be a lawn. They're about 500 square feet each. And I used short grass sand prairie mixes, I believe, from your establishment, Neil.
Okay.
And they've worked very well, but what I need to know is how to best maintain them. I know that it would be best probably to burn them, but they're too close to the cottage to do that. And some years we've mowed them down or just sort of hacked them down and have raked off. And I've actually established some areas on our sand beach where things have come up with that. And last fall, we were unable to get up here and do anything with them, and they seem to have come up just fine. So what would you recommend for the best ways to maintain these areas?
Okay, that's a great question. You're very fortunate that you have sandy soil, because prairies are easier to maintain on dry sandy soils than they are on richer, more medium or mesic soils, because there's lots more weeds that grow on good soils than grow on bad soils or poor soils. So you have an inherent advantage right there. Secondarily, if you can't burn, exactly what you're doing is the second best choice, which is to mow everything down and to remove it, to open up the soil so that it's subject to the incoming rays of the sun to help it warm up rapidly in the spring. And most of your prairie plants are warm season flowers and grasses. Not all, but most, and they like it hot. So if you leave all the mulch on the surface, that blocks the incoming sun in the spring, and tends to favor cool season weeds like quackgrass or brome grass or white clover or red clover or a variety of other non-native species that can bedevil the efforts of your prairie. So you're doing exactly the right thing. Well, one thing I would suggest you might want to change is you're cutting this down in the fall, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. If your goal is to foster pollinators, the best thing you could do is actually leave the prairie stand up all winter. And then when you go up to the cottage, I'm assuming you'd be there first time is what, late April, early May? Is that an accurate guess?
Generally, yes.
Okay. So around in Shell Lake, mow everything down on May 1st or thereabouts, and then you can remove that. And this allows all of the dead material to stand where a lot of pollinators can overwinter, sometimes as adults, sometimes as pupae, sometimes as eggs. And that will help replenish the population of pollinators. And most of them will probably have emerged or hatched or whatever, hopefully, before you mow everything down in May. So
that's good.
That will give you a more ecological approach to your prairie garden. It'll extend it to be even more valuable to pollinators, et cetera.
Yeah, there you go, Debbie. Thank you so much. Lois in DeForest, on to you. Hi, Lois.
Hi. I just have a simple question, I think. I want to start a very small prairie area in my front yard, and I have prairie grass mix. I want to get it started as soon as possible. Could I sow these seeds this fall before winter? I've grown milkweed from seed often, or just dispersed it, but I'm not sure about prairie grass.
Okay, what prairie grass seeds do you have? Do you know the species?
Yes, little and tall blue stem. There's an Indian grass. Let me see here. Switchgrass. I think one or two others.
Okay, and it's just grasses, no flowers. Is that correct?
I think she said blue stem.
Yeah, little blue stem and then the big blue stem.
Yeah, okay, little blue stem, big blue stem. Mm-hmm. Do you have any flowers or is it just the grasses?
I do have just the grasses now, but I was going to spread flower seeds too, or when?
Okay, well, as we talked about earlier, the flowers are best seeded in the fall, and those grasses are best seeded in the spring. So you can go ahead and seed them all in the fall. You'll just see reduced germination of the grasses, but increased germination of the flowers compared to seeding them in spring. But before we even get to that, is this area in your lawn, has it been prepared, or has all the lawn been killed or dug up or removed so you have bare soil and no weeds or grass?
Yes, the area is prepared. I actually did it last fall, and so it is ready to be planted.
Okay. So you can, if you wish, you can put the flower seed down this fall separately. And then in late winter, you can frost seed the grasses when the ground is just between that freezing and thawing stage, probably sometime in early March. And that will give you better germination on the grasses and the best possible germination on the flowers that you seeded in the fall.
There you go, Lois. Good luck. Appreciate your call. We had some emails, Loretta, and you may see these, you may be able to see these, Neil. Loretta in Eau Claire emailed some photos of her prairies. She says goldenrod is taking over her prairie. She's wondering, should she still cut stems of goldenrods and where, about 6 inches or less or more?
Oh, boy. Canada goldenrod?
I don't know.
Let's see here. Oh, here we go. All right. Here we go. I've got the picture now. So that looks like Canada goldenrod. Yes. Yes. The dreaded and hated Canada goldenrod. But let's not blame the Canadians because it's not their fault. So, yes. Canada goldenrod is the most vexing of perennial weeds. I mean, this is a native weed. It is a true thug. and it is arguably the most problematic unwanted plant in our prairies. I will take Canada thistle over Canada goldenrod in most situations. So how do we control Canada goldenrod? There are numerous ways to do this. There are chemical methods and there are non-chemical methods where you substitute mowing. So let's look at herbicide methods. Okay. Gary Eldred, the founder of the Prairie Enthusiast, has dealt with all kinds of different weeds. And here's what he does to control Canada goldenrod. He goes out this time of year with some twine and he bundles together 6, 8, 10 of the stems because they tend to grow in clones, bundles them together. And then he has a little spray bottle and he sprays herbicide on them. You can use Roundup. You can use a broadleaf herbicide. He uses a broadleaf herbicide and just spray the upper couple feet of the plant because usually there's good prairie plants underneath it. And you don't want any drift of that herbicide down on the plants below because you can damage or kill them. And so the herbicide then is translocated down into the roots and kills the goldenrods. And he has really good results using this. Another method is to wait until the goldenrod is coming up in the spring. When they're about 3 or 4 inches tall, you can go out with a backpack sprayer or a small hand sprayer, and you remove the wand and the nozzle the nozzle from the wand, and you tape a half of a clear soft drink bottle, like a 16-ounce soft drink bottle, cut it in half, keep the end that has the top on it, the spout, tape that on to your wand, put the nozzle back on, and now you have a cone of death that contains the spray. So the nozzle is right at the level where the drinking part of the half of the bottle is.
Yeah.
So then you can put that over the newly sprouted Canada goldenrod with a broadleaf herbicide. Roundup doesn't work very well because the energy of the plant is coming up. You need a broadleaf herbicide. And you spray it on those 4-inch tall goldenrod sprouts. And you use this cone so it doesn't spray around anywhere else. It doesn't drift onto adjacent desirable vegetation. And you can cover a lot of territory, but you got to hit each new sprout individually. And you got to know what the Canada goldenrod looks like when it's coming up. Okay? If you have a large field and you don't want to use herbicides, you can use the Dr. David Atwell 2-year cutting method. And this is a client of mine for whom I planted a significant prairie, and he had an invasion with Canada goldenrod. And he went on his own, he's a genius, he went on his own and devised this methodology, which now is widely used successfully. He goes in mid-June and mows the prairie down to 6 inches, which whacks back a bunch of prairie plants, but it doesn't kill them. But it really hurts the Canada goldenrod. Then he comes back. When the Canada goldenrod is in full bloom, usually late August, early September, it's coming up very soon, and cuts it at 12 inches. And you'll notice the Canada goldenrod tends to lose all of its lower leaves in the later season. So when you cut it at 12 inches, it removes all of the leaves of the Canada goldenrod, but it leaves 12 inches of the leaves of the prairie plants, flowers and grasses. So they're still okay. They're cut back, but they're okay. You do this 2 years in succession, mowing at 6 inches in mid-June and 12 inches in late August, early September. In 2 years, you can virtually eliminate Canada goldenrod.
Wow.
I have many customers who have used this method. They have replicated Dr. Atwell's initial study, and it has worked really, really well. So there you have it.
There you have it. Thank you so much for that question. Ruth in Edgerton has a question for you. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for
Good.
Taking my call. Good. We also had a new septic put in. Now we have a total mud field in the front yard. But I also do doggy daycare. So I didn't know if there's some sustainable prairie grass that would be good to have numerous dogs running around on it.
Well, you know, that's very interesting. I have a client, and this year they just planted, 28 acres of no-mow and prairie grass in two separate areas for their dog training. Now, they train hunting dogs. And so this is on dry, sandy soil, so they planted little blue stem and side oats grama, which are lower-growing grasses, 2 to 3 feet high, which go on dry sand. And then they planted our no-mow lawn mix, which only grows usually 6 inches, and then the seed heads will go up maybe knee high. And they use this for their dog training. So these are dog-friendly grasses. They're not too tall, so the dogs get lost in them. But if you have, like, you're in DeForest, you said?
Edgerton.
Edgerton.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Okay, and so you have, like, really good black dirt probably, right, in Edgerton?
Yeah, good soil.
Yeah. Okay. Little bluestem will grow in loamy soil, but it won't grow in clay. So do you have a loamy soil, a clay soil? What do you have as far as soil type?
I would have to Google. Earlier I was listening, so I'd have to Google what the soil type is. Not a lot of clay. They didn't hit a lot when they were digging. So,
okay. Not a lot of clay. Okay. Yeah. Little bluestem and Cytogram would do best on a sandy loam, loamy sand, and up to loamy soil. So it sounds to me like you'd probably be just fine if you wanted to use those two low-growing prairie grasses. The Cytogram is relatively fast-growing. It will usually mature in 2 years. The little bluestem usually takes 3 years. And as long as you don't mind something that's 2 to 3 feet high, do you think that would work for your situation?
I think it would work awesome. The dogs love running through the higher grass, so it would work great. So awesome. Can I find this on your website, too, if I Google you?
Absolutely. And if they like high grass, then you've got taller grasses like switchgrass, Indian grass, and big bluestem, which get anywhere from 5 to 8 feet tall. Maybe that's too tall. I don't know. That would be up to your decision.
I could do a mixture of both because we've got about an acre, so that would be great.
Let me make a suggestion. Plant one area of tall grass and one area of short grass, so we'll have two different places to play.
Exactly. That'd be perfect. Thank you so much for the advice. I appreciate it.
You bet.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Kathy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to transplant some of my black-eyed Susans, and I was just wondering what time of the year is best.
Are these black-eyed Susans that are blooming?
Yes.
Okay, and do you know the species of the black-eyed Susan?
I'm afraid I don't.
Okay, do they have fuzzy leaves?
No, no fuzzy leaves.
Okay, so is this possibly Rudbeckia fulgida? How tall are they?
I would say probably 2 feet tall.
2 feet tall. Okay. Well, we need to determine if you have Rudbeckia fulgida, Rudbeckia hirta, or Rudbeckia triloba. And you're probably not going to be able to tell me that, right?
No.
Okay. Okay. Here's my concern. The classic black-eyed Susan, Rudbeckia hirta, which has fuzzy leaves, is a biennial. And so after it blooms, it makes seeds and it dies. So if you transplant them, you're transplanting a plant that's basically going to die shortly. So there would be no utility in transplanting them unless you just wanted to put them in hospice care for a month.
I started with just one plant, and and that was like probably 10 or 12 years ago, and it just keeps, propagating by itself.
Yes, and black-eyed Susan is particularly adept at that. And then I bet you probably have the biennial black-eyed Susan because it's sowing onto open soil. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yep, that is classic Rudbeckia hirta. So if you want to transplant it, you want to go and find the little babies. So do you have little small ones? Can you find the seedlings? Okay, it's a biennial. So the first year, it forms little basal rosettes of leaves, but it won't bloom. Okay, the second year, it grows rapidly, blooms, makes seeds, and dies. So you don't want to transplant the blooming plants. You want to go and find those smaller little leaves that are anywhere from probably 2 to 5 feet across in diameter and transplant those. And it is bulletproof. You cannot screw this up. You cannot mess up planting black-eyed Susan. It's basically a weed. So you have very good results by doing that. And that would be a great time to do it. Make sure you get some soil ball around the roots and you'll have black-eyed Susans galore.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Kathy. Good luck.
Lori in Gladstone, Michigan emailed, she planted too much sneezeweed, Alenium autumnale? Opinale. In one of her native beds, and she doesn't want to, she wants to transplant some of it. Is it better to do this at the end of the growing season in fall, or should she wait till spring?
Either one is fine. Helenium autumnale, then sneezeweed, you'd really have to work at killing that one. So if you wait until it goes dormant in fall, you can dig it up, and it's going to be, if it's mature, it's going to be a big hunk of root. And if you want more sneezeweed, but it sounds like maybe she doesn't, but if she does, it's easily divided. You can do root divisions, and that one big plant will yield you 4, 5, 6 new plants, and you can divide them in the fall, or you can wait until early spring before they come up or just when they're starting to come up and dig them up and divide them as well at that time.
Kay in Waterford emailed. She has Joe Pieweed. That's been a shorter version of the native plant. This year was an extraordinary year, and the plant not only spread and produced more stalks and flowers than ever before, it grew several feet tall than it has in the past. She loves the plant, but it's at its current height, it doesn't work well in the garden it's in. If she wants to move it, when should she do so?
Same thing. Wait until the plant is dormant, and either at the end of the growing season in fall or early in spring before they come up. And I can tell you this, Joe Pieweed is easily pruned back into a more compact squat plant. You can't hurt that one. So in June, cut it back to, if it's 2 feet tall, cut it back to a foot high, probably sometime in June, early July, and it will spread out, branch out, and stay lower.
Janine from Arborvita emailed. She has a shady slope area, 6+ hours a day of shade. It's never been planted. Right now it's covered with weeds and pine straw. She's curious what she should do now to get the area ready for spring and what prairie plants would work best in that area.
So she says 6 hours of sun per day?
6 hours a day of shade.
Oh, shade. Okay. So I'm assuming that that is at this time of the year. And right now we're getting about 14 hours of sun a day. So that would be 6 hours of shade and 8 hours of sun. So as long as you have at least 50% of direct sun per day, you can grow practically all the prairie plants. And many of the prairie plants will take less than a half a day of full sun. Not all, but many. So as long as she has at least a half a day of full sun, she can select from any of the prairie plants that are suited to her soil type. And so she'll want to be careful that if it's a sandy soil, a dry sandy soil, that she picks plants for dry sand. If it's a nice loamy soil, that she picks plants for loam. If it's a heavy clay soil, there are numerous plants that will grow in heavy clay. And then she can pick the ones that are the right height for her situation. So as far as preparing it, you'd want to scrape away all of the duff and all of the old needles to get down to the mineral soil to make sure that you're planting the plant into the mineral soil. And again, I would encourage her to do a soil test to test for the pH and phosphorus, potassium, calcium, and magnesium to make sure that her soil is suitable for growing plants effectively.
Yeah, and she should do that before she probably does anything else, I suppose.
Yes, I would do that right away. And fall is a great time for taking soil samples and sending them into the state lab in Marshfield. And it's the Wisconsin Forage, what is it, Larry? Forage and Soil
and Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory.
Thank you. Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory. And if you just Google that in Marshfield, you'll get their information. And they have a form. You'd want to take the standard garden test, but then add calcium and magnesium to the test because that is not included in the standard test. And that's going to cost you all of about $24, I think.
Yeah. On that note, Neil, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. Always a pleasure. I look forward to your next visit.
Larry, thank you so much. It's always great to be with you.
Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist. PrairieNursery.com is the place to go for his business. Thank you so much for listening. Monday, we'll talk with our physical therapy guest about how to decide if your next medical provider visit should be in person or virtual, among other things. And in the meantime, I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend. I'm Larry Mueller.